The ship was held stationary by the ice pack and was slowly being crushed. Otto Schmidt, the commander and chief of Arctic exploration, ordered all supplies and gear to be taken off of the vessel and transported to a relatively smooth patch of ice near the where the ship sank and set up a camp. With the radio gear they had salvaged from the ship, they contacted the stations on shore, giving them their position and on the ice wall. To give you an amazing part of this expedition, I must tell you that when I was in Moscow later on, they showed me a film that was taken as the Chelyuskin was being crushed by the ice. It was a moving film in the hull of the vessel. Rivets at least 2 inches in diameter were having the heads popped off of them in the water rushing in until the pressure finally just sank the vessel. But I mean, that was amazing. I mean, those Russians got to be a little goofy, you know, and be dumb having the rivets all popping off, you know. There was only one loss of life on this deal, and that was a crew member who went back aboard to get his girlfriend's picture. And he said the vessel sank while he was there. That was the only fatality in the whole deal. To get back to the rescue mission, the Russians started sending planes from their airports in Siberia to Cape Van Tern. These planes were all single engine, water-cooled engines, and two of them that finally arrived at Cape Van Tern were biplanes, open cockpit, and they had a metal cylinder under each lower wing, you know, kind of like a drop tank. So they'd go out on the ice floe, pick up these guys, and can you imagine sticking your head in one of these drop tanks, you know? You couldn't see her. So they had a passenger in each one of those, and then the cockpit was designed for two people, but they could put four in there, you know. So after we got them to camp, and you know, it's cold, you know, too. How'd you like to lay in one of those things? After we got them to camp, there's Eskimos from all over the world there, you know, at Siberia, and we taken by dog team down the coast, and eventually we arrived at Anadyr, where there was an open port, and they were put on a boat and sent back home. The most modern aircraft, which I think is interesting, was that there were German junkers. They were also single engine with water-cooled engines. But one of these had an auxiliary gas engine, and they would run the exhaust through the manifold of the airplane's engine and keep it warm all night long, so that way they didn't have to fire upon it. You know, that was the most modern thing I saw over there. Well, as you can realize, what a task it was to heat up these other airplanes, you know. Of course, ours, you know, we had like cyclones and all we had to do was get the oil and firepot. But the Russians didn't know what a firepot was, you know. So these biplanes, we'd have to heat up 20 gallons of water for each plane, put it on a dog sled, go about a quarter of a mile out in the ice where it was smooth, and dump the water in, okay, the hot water. So in starting the engine on these things, they had a shock cord with a sock on the end of it, and they put that on one blade of the propeller. Then you get about 4 to 5 Eskimos, and one guy would hang on to the other blade of the propeller, and these guys would stretch the shock cord, and then the guy would say, okay, and let go. But it'd only go over one revolution. And if it didn't start, you're in bad trouble. So after all this monkey business, you know, if it only, you'd try it maybe 15 times, you know. And then by then the water was cold, so you'd have to drain the water out of the thing, go back up to the camp and heat the water and begin all over again. So the Russians, now the reasons that that I and Clyde Armistead got on this deal. The Russians sent Commander Maurice Sletnev, who incidentally was a pilot who brought Eielson and Borland's bodies back from Siberia to Alaska, and another pilot named Sigismund Levinsky. They sent them, you know, by boat, didn't have airplanes flying across the ocean then, and they arrived in Fairbanks in March. And they purchased two single-engine consolidated Fleisters. Now, these airplanes had a metal fuselage. They were similar to a Lockheed V, but they had a metal fuselage, but they had a plywood wing. They were powered by a Wright Cyclone engine and were equipped with nose shutters, oil shutters, and all that gear that was pertinent for winter operation. The cruising speed was approximately 130 miles per hour on skis. The only disadvantage, they didn't have any flaps on the thing, so it had a high landing speed, which we found out, and this caused problems on short fields or out in the ice floe. Due to the fact the Russian pilots were not familiar with American machines, and also they were used to all instruments and everything doing in the metric, which ours weren't. And then another fact was they did not speak English or understand it. So Sletnev, who was in charge, asked Joe Crossan, who he met during this Eielson-Borland search, you know, and so forth, when Joe and Willem found Eielson-Borland over there. He asked him to find him a couple of guys goofy enough to go along with these fellows. They got two airplanes, 703 and 704Y. So Joe talked to Clyde and I, and after Joe convinced my mother, we had to do a little talking, that it would be okay, you know, that I wouldn't get killed. She had to sign a paper to the Russians giving permission, you know, to go along, as I was underage, you know, at that time. So I was assigned to Sletnev in 703Y and Clyde to Levinsky in 704Y. We're briefed on all the things that we had to do to maintain the airplane. And then another thing we had to do was take along tetraethyl lead, because the gasoline in Siberia is very low test. Later on, you'll hear about this. You know, but so we had to have math on everything. It's very volatile, you know, and everything. So we had to mix it up. So now, if you're not tired of listening to this, I'll go on with the other. Okay? Jeez, I wish I had a drink. I'm getting dry. Well, anyway, this, I had a heck of a time with this. I had a diary. I wrote this diary, and you know, and I was real proud of it. This is 1934, you know, a long time. And this flood comes. And of course, all the, you know, everything got wet and all the ink ran around, and oh God, I had a heck of a time. So when I was manager of the Fairbanks Airport and sitting around there with nothing to do, we had an IBM machine, and so I, being the only one who could read the diary, you know, I put her on this tape. Jesus, don't you have any water or anything around here? So anyway, I got it all on this tape, and of course it was an old machine, and then, gosh, I had a heck of a time in Fairbanks to finally get somebody that had an IBM that would run these belt tapes. Well, here I'll start off. This is on Tuesday, March 27th, 1934. Jeez. Where's that Spencer? Huh? Well, tell him bring me a Coke or something, or vodka. Well, anyway, we got the planes ready to go at 9:30 a.m. Morris Sletnev and Lyman Peck arrive at 10 a.m. with baggage, remove the wheels from the 703 line, put in their baggage and so forth. And I started 703 and revved it up, and we took off at 10:45 a.m., circled the field and saw 704 on the runway. That was with Levinsky and Clyde in there, and headed for Nolato. Well, motor started heating up. Went past Astrodome, so check mixer control, shutters on nose and air scoop. Temperature kept increasing, so opened shutters and oil tank. Helped a little, so had Morris pull the throttle back. All these Russians could do was just, you know, run the control and the throttle. I mean, they couldn't understand what was going on with any of this other jazz. But we have a signal. He'd be saying, that's okay. That's bad, you know. So anyway, we arrived at Nolato. And we warmed up the planes, and the Nome radio station was haywire, so it couldn't get the weather. But we left at 10:45 a.m. on March the 28th. Got a little shot there? Good. Thank you. Well, I'll try both of them. Water. Dirty dog. So anyway, we left on March the 28th and had a hell of a time getting to Nome. We landed a mile offshore and had to taxi in. But the people of Nome were real fine. They all came out in Madison and so forth. So the next day, on March the 29th, we got poor old Clyde and Levinsky all loaded up and dissertate a little bit. Levinsky was a Pole who came over to the Russian, to the communist side. Now you see, Sletnev was a Russian, I mean, a born and bred Russian. Of course, he belonged to nobility, and they had a little time with him too. But Levinsky was a Pole. So he wanted to be the first guy over there. Well, so they took off, and the weather was horrible. They took off, and we heard from East Cape that they had passed there at 1:15 p.m., and nothing since. So we got our airplane all gathered up and everything, and then we got the message. He crash landed in the Aleutian Islands. But luckily, all he got was a sprained wrist and Clyde died. He got out of it okay. So then, Morris and I, we took off and we took off. Christ, and away we go over to, we get going across, you know. And there's an awful lot of open water. Oh. And the compass, you know, started going like so. I think we got the East Cape. I'm not too sure because you couldn't see anything, you know. But then we didn't know which way to go, you know. So I got it. He climbed up and got a shot of the sun, you know, where it was at that time of year. And we came back and landed at Teller. So we stayed overnight at Keller, and then that was Sunday, yeah. So I could go on here for hours, you know, reading all this jazz, but that's a quick deal. So then on Monday, this is just typical of anybody that's ever flown an airplane. On Monday, we were ready to go by noon, but the skis were closing in. This was a teller, and so we didn't get away until 1:05. And we made her over to East Cape and stayed there until, let's see. Gee, that was a crazy place, I tell you. And nobody spoke English, and we took the huts, you know, they're oval, and, you know, it's round. And you got skins on top of it. And these darn Eskimos, you know, sit up there, and they'd have a little rag, you know, maybe about this big. They'd be sweeping the snow off of it. Yeah. Of course, they're visiting with the next door neighbor. You know, we're talking, you know, like crazy people. Well, we stayed there for quite a while, and let's see. I'm going to try and hurry through this so you people can see when we leave. Oh, yeah. Okay. So it was on the 6th, we finally left Whalen or East Cape, and we had uneventful trip up the coast. It must have been good, yeah. But we arrived at Cape Van Camp. So then on Saturday, we took off and went over to the ice floe. As I told you, that without flaps, you know, this airplane landed pretty much, and the ice floes weren't very smooth. So knocked off the tail end of the airplane. You know. So just the stabilizer. So then we had to send a bunch of Eskimos and everything down where Clyde and the guy had cracked up, where the other airplane luckily didn't damage the tail end of it, you know. So we went down there and got that off, the stabilizer and tail end off it. Then we had to bring it up. That was about 100 and some miles down there by dog team. And then brought that up and to Cape Van Caram and put it on one of them Russian outdoor airplanes, you know, like I started flying in, you know, and flew it over there and put it on the 703. And Otto Schmidt, who was the head of the expedition and was on the boat, he was sick, and so we fetched him into Cape Van Caram. That is the funny thing about that. I didn't know who he was. Clyde didn't know who he was. And we're the only two Americans, you know, that could speak, you know, English. And so I said, who's that bearded old bastard? You know, I said, geez, they're giving him a lot of help, you know, and everything. And so, after 2 or 3 days, you know, I, they're waiting on him hand and foot. And we're living in a little goddamn place about the size of this deal here, and there was 18 of us in there sleeping. Incidentally, I the first night I was there, I'll never forget it. In the middle of the night, this guy lights a candle, you know, and holds up his underwear and fiddling around. What the hell he's doing that for? I found out. Oh boy, we're all lousy, I tell you. Hell, when finally we got the heck out of there, and we made several more trips, and we got out of there and went back to Nome. I'm going to hurry through this. I know you people are getting tired of listening. So we got back to Nome, and they had a thin path there, So Clyde and I went in the Finn bath. Now, this is winter time. We took all our clothes off, I mean, right down to bare skin, and dumped them outside the Finn bath, and then went in there and steamed good. We had some new clothes to put on. Gosh, I'd heard about this, but I'd never had it. Yeah. So, So anyway, we fiddle around there in Nome with the deal, and we were going to take Schmidt back to Fairbanks, but the stabilizer that we'd put on the airplane, it wasn't in too good a shape either. And so seeing that this Otto Schmidt was the head guy, you know, of the Arctic research or whatever you want to call it, you know, they decided that maybe we'd better not fly him back. Of course, it was all right to bring him off the ice and to know him, but they decided to heck with it. So I came to Fairbanks and by commercial and got another stabilizer and Frank Pollock and I tied it underneath the other Stinson and we tied it underneath there and flew it to back to Nome. And the icebreaker Krassen came in to Nome, and that was the earliest time that a boat had ever gotten into Nome at that time. And then they loaded the airplane on board that and flew Schmidt to Fairbanks and on out to Moscow, where I lay sawing. Turned out I. But they, and then when I went to Moscow to get the medal, showed me the airplane. I guess what they did, they got the rights to manufacture the consolidated airplane. So, that's about all. If anybody wants to see this thing, there, that's it. That's the order of Lenin, huh? Yeah, order of Lenin, yeah, or Lenin. Yeah. Yeah, there, at the time we got this, Clyde and I, there was only one other person. That, what was his name? Anyway, he was an engineer, and he designed and built Nepastoya Dam. I got it for 5 years, and then they told me the 5-year plan took care of that, you know. So, no more do I get her. And I've written letters and everything else. And he says, well, no, that 5-year plan, you know. I didn't, according to my directions, like, no way, you know, I'm supposed to get it. But I do have travel permits and everything. I can go anywhere in Russia, you know. Or on a Russian airplane or boat or something, you know. Pardon? I don't want to go there. So I guess that's about all I got to say.
I want you to take note of how hard the Russians were striving for knowledge, that they would invite these people over and Bill and to issue this medal to them. They were, shall we say, very anxious to get ahead. They knew they didn't know it all, and their ways and equipment were inferior. And I want to tell you a short story to back this up. While they were ferrying airplanes from through Fairbanks to Siberia, a colonel came in and talked to John Cross, who was the base commander in Nome, and he said, where can I get my teeth fixed? John Cross said, "Well, you go and see old Doc LaRue in Fairbanks. Tell him I sent you." So he went in and he was there about a couple of weeks getting quite a few bridges and inlays in his teeth. And so they did LaRue did a fine job on him. So he went back to Russia and he went to the dental school there to show him what fine teeth, fine work LaRue had done on his teeth. So they said, "For the good of the country, we want to pull your teeth and put them on the stand here for all of our students to see." So about 3 weeks later, the colonel came through again, and John Cross said, "How did your teeth do?" "Oh, just fine." He said, he pulled out an aluminum plate, showed John, and he contributed his teeth for the country. This is how hard they were striving to get ahead. You can see how they're catching up on us today. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a break here for a little bit. Let everybody stretch their legs. I need to make a few announcements. I had a meeting last night with the people that are participating in this, and I need to find out how many of them are here by checking in. There's a lunch being prepared at the Captain Cook. For people on per diem, don't worry about it. For the people that are not on per diem, it'll cost you $8.60. The schedule is to leave here at noon, go to the Cook, we'll have a 2-hour lunch break, and if some of these people are not here, we will have limited openings for others that might want to join. We have to get 45 people for this lunch because we've contracted for it. George Hall, Jim McGee, Christy Carey, Dick Reeve, Bob Gleason, Ray Peterson, Orville Tosh, Howard Lovering, Gretchen Boeing, Ed Maloney, Tony Schultz, Jim Fredenhagen, Randy Acord, Marion Acord, Jim Hutchison, Bob Ellis, Cecil Higgins, Frank Barr, Masataki Okamiya, Tom Spittler, John Klo, Charles Pinney, Stan Long, Lyman Woodman, Admiral Russell, Bob Rice, Bill Avery, Lillian Crossan, Frizzell, Bob Stevens, Morgan Richardson, Jack Mays, Dana Nichols, Reg Emmert, Bob Owenbrink, Fred Walaka, Warren Dodson, Merrill Ween, Brian Peck and his party of five, and Clayton Scott. Now, if you know of any of these people that are not here, please let me know, because we'd like to fill their spot up. And I think it would be a real unique experience. Also, I want to make some announcements about the dinner and the banquet. The banquet is on Sunday at the Captain Cook. We're going to ask people that will not be speaking at this particular event to speak at that event. It'll be a more casual atmosphere. We're going to show a lot of home movies that people have made over the years, some dating back to the 30s, on aviation. And the cost of the dinner is $25. Ingrid Peterson from the 99ers is consented to help me out here a little bit, and you can talk to her at the front desk. We need to get a 48 to 24 hour notice on the number of meals. The menu is crab legs and salmon, and it's unrestricted as far as attendance. If you got $25, you can come. And we'll break for 20 minutes, and then we'll get cracking here with Mr. Hutchison. Thank you. One of our scheduled speakers, unless he turns up from out of nowhere, Mr. Jack Mays of the Transportation Museum has apparently not made it. He lives in Palmer, and there may be some poor road conditions or something.
I was thinking of the top of the video, and the video takes around
Yeah, this is something that the Glen Highway is apparently closed, and there was an accident. We will not be able, we've missed the first segment of this thing as far as videotaping. We do have sound recordings. And perhaps at a later date, we can get these same gentlemen together and do the videotape. The purpose of the videotape is to develop an educational package for future generations. We're going to try to make some attempts to get some video equipment from the FAA this afternoon, and there's a possibility we can capture some of it. I have a few more little things to say here before we get on with our program. Sheila Furr from the State Film Library is requesting that any of you ladies or gentlemen that have historical documents, diaries, any kind of paper with history on it pertaining to aviation, if you could make it available to the state library so they can do some photocopying. We're trying to gather up as much of this history as we can. And only you know what you have. And you may not think it's very significant, but believe me, if it pertains to the aviation history in any way, it is. Also on the lunch, by the way, Sheila is here, and she's sitting right back there with her arm raised. If you have something like that, you might contact her. The next gentleman is going to introduce our next speaker. A lot of people have told me that this man is one of the more significant figures in Alaskan aviation history, and his name sure pops up a lot. I'm not even going to go into his history because I don't know it all. I'm proud to say that he's my grandfather, and I'd like to introduce my uncle, Randy Acord.
It is with pleasure that I stand here and be able to introduce this next speaker. And I've been accused by my wife many times that I only married her so I could have an aviation mechanic. But I heard several people asking outside a few minutes ago about, Hutch, are you still working? Sure. He still works his 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. And they said, well, how old are you now? He says, well, I don't normally tell those things. But anyway, his birthday is on Valentine's Day, and he's born in 1900. So I won't go into all the details. Maybe he will bring some of them up. We have a vocational school in Fairbanks. It's named after James T. Hutchison, Sr. He is a FAA Aviation Mechanic of the Year Award man for developing new hydraulic systems for the nose wheel of the C-130 Hercules. They are now incorporated in production. He was one of the first aluminum welders in the territory of Alaska. He is still one of the best known welders in this area. And believe it or not, I've watched him weld magnesium. And he does a beautiful job at it. At this time, I'd like to introduce James T. Hutchison, Sr. Thank you.
has a pretty good send-off for an old man. But seems like everybody on the program was either a flyer or something or other with the aviation. And I've been a mechanic for so long now that I think I'm going to speak for all the mechanics. And to get the thing started off, I heard Tony saying something about teeth, you know, and I had an experience years ago with mine. I was working for Frank Pollock, and along Brennan cracked an airplane up down a moose creek in the conditioner, and I went down to fix it up. And I just got a new set of teeth. And that was, 1936, I think, 1936. And Bob Osley, who's now a captain for probably retired Northwest, and what's his name out there at Folks Field? Anyway, he was the helpers. And they, we had to pack, we were staying with Fanny Quigley up in one of her cabins, and we had to pack wood every night from where the airplane was up to where we were staying. And this particular night, my teeth were hurting to beat the band. They were brand new, you know. And so I took them out and put them on a bowl, and like a nut, I put them on the end of the stove. Well, the cabin got kind of warm, and I thought to myself, you know, I was sitting there reading Jess Bachner. He'd went over and throwed a couple of sticks of wood in the fire. And geez, I began to feel a little warm, and I thought of my teeth. I went over, and they were just the same shape as the bottom of the bowl. So that's my tooth story, Tony. But I had lots of experience fixing airplanes, lots of fun, lots of work. And of course, I could tell, I could talk on and on and on about the number I've fixed. And I've been trying to sit here and think of the one that would interest you most. And it's kind of tough. I used to sing in a choir in Fairbanks, and one time Phil Lavery and Peterson, they cracked up an airplane out Central or somewhere out in the...
Fireman.
Huh? Yeah, okay. So,
yeah. It was on Easter Sunday.
Now, wait a minute. Anyway, I was working at the NC and working at airplanes at the same time. And they knocked the landing gear off this traveler, and they wanted me to go over and fix it. So I made a landing gear, and it was an Easter morning. And I was in the choir singing Easter hymns, you know. And Bill said, "Oh, no problem, we'll get you in time, you know, no problem at all." So we got up 4 o'clock in the morning, and he flew me out there, and I fixed the landing gear. And we watched Albert take the thing off, and we left. And I made it by the skin of my teeth. The choir was just walking in when that came in. Made it. Sang. Wonderful. Well, that was one experience. Now, let's see. Of course, going to Siberia, that's something else again. That's kind of old hat. And it was real interesting. We didn't have any radio, no nothing to lead us, you know. We had to find a way, and we took off from Fairbanks and following a pilot by the name of Matt Niemann. And of course, we got separated and had to land. That was on the first go. We landed up in the mountains behind Unicleet, knocked some 5 feet of the wing off the airplane, and we were able to fix it, and a week later we flew it out, flew down to Unicleet and on to Nome.